Well, I think is Father Nick here? Now we have a slight dilemma because the next chair isn't here. It's a virtual chair. And I'm not quite sure. You're pointing to Jim? Mick,
Hey!
must we? Really, was that the decision of the committee? Oh,
yeah.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
I knew I shouldn't have come. Jim, bless your heart. Thank you.
That's yours, Jim.
Oh,
this is just
getting. Yeah. Oh. He can't be an LP. Let his
what drink. Now, I'm just going to do it at the end. All right. I've been overruled by a very bossy, militant feminist old-timer, and now is the time to give Emma her book. Emma, would you like to come up here?
Yay.
I'm not even going to introduce you. This is a disgrace.
Do you know, this is the first time we... Oh, look, you can't even handle one of these.
No,
no wonder your wife...
That's got a back in it. We don't need that.
Well, they maybe wouldn't want to hear you.
That's best.
I think that's best. No, it's the first time we actually you've
Thomas
been
will
with
go
me,
mad.
Jeremy.
He wants to recover. He wants this recorded. Thomas will go mad. We'll get told off.
Oh, dear. We've got all these.
I know.
Right.
Well, my name's Mick, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Ferret.
And they call me the Ferret in this fellowship. It was given to me by a bloke named Big Pat, who was an older member of this fellowship, and because there was a lot of Micks, and I keep Ferret, so he said, you know, I'll call you Mick the Ferret from now on. And I keep it because he's died, and it's a memory towards him. I've heard a lot of wonderful things today, you know, and I don't know how I can top it, which I don't really want to, but I have only one story, and many of you have heard it, and so I'll start from the beginning, you know. I came into AA reluctantly. I knew I was an alcoholic, but I like to think that I was a drinking alcoholic. I worked from the age of 15 to 29 in a wet brewery, and that's where I learned my trade. I was supposed to have been a mechanic, and all I ended up was an alcoholic. You know, before I started to work, I was a around, I don't know which way it goes, round peg in a square hole in a round peg, I don't know. And I always felt uncomfortable. I'd grown up in a really rough area. This is Henley-on-Thames, you know. They did have rough areas. And the street I grew up in was called Blood and Gut Street. And the police used to come up in twos with dogs. That's before my time, but the reputation stayed, and we were brought up to be tough. But inside me was a very soft cut guy, and I kept it hidden. I didn't like hurting people, physically, mentally, or spiritually, but I did, you know. And I always wanted to be someone else, not me. I always thought I wasn't clever enough. In a fight, I always thought I wasn't tough enough. And so I went to work at this brewery, and the guys I worked with were very heavy drinkers. And they used to keep booze in the stable. And they used to creep off over to the stables and have a drink, or go out on testing vehicles and drinking. Well, while they were gone, I tried a drink, and I loved what it done to me. It changed me. Made me think that I was whole, made me feel whole, that I was a man. But in the brewery, I wasn't allowed to have a drink because of my age. But we used to have a wet bar where it was a tap room where there was two barrels of beer and a case of minerals. And you, any time you went past, you could drink. And as time went on, that's what I done. I lied, I cheated, and I stole for alcohol. I got to know all the right people in the brewery where alcohol was available. Mineral Factory, there was a case of beer under the table, the office, in their office. Wine and Spirits, we had a very nice, kind man, and you've made up a lie, he'd give you a drink. You know, like, I feel rough, I've got pain in my stomach, I've unsettled stomach, so he'd give you a port and brandy. I used to do all private work for everybody that, like the off-license manager, anybody who had a vehicle in the brewery, and there was always drink. I found out that I had a large capacity for drinking, and I boasted about it. I drank in beer drinking competitions, fastest pints, a yard of ales, and in one of the pubs that have gone now, they used to have a 4.5-pint glass boot. And if you could drink that without it spilling, without taking it from your mouth, you didn't have to pay. So we used to go there. I was a beatnik. I got involved one stage with drugs and booze. My mother's house was raided by the police, so I vowed not to carry drugs or have drugs. Not to carry, to have drugs at home or anywhere. But I did carry for a while. But then I chose alcohol as my drug of my choice. All the older blokes were warning me what would happen to me if I continued on the path I was following. And I thought it was because I was a young lad and they was all old guys. You know, when I first went to the brewery, all it was full of was criminals and alcoholics. I went to a meeting last night. And it was one of our bosses talking about the brewery I worked at. And his story was completely different to what I knew of Breakspears. And, you know, because he said in one of the parts that they had a man there that used to, by break time, he would have drank half a gallon of beer. Well, I knew this man, and his first job, 4 o'clock in the morning, was to fill up a stainless steel bucket with beer, take it up to where he worked, and every half hour he would go down with a quart jug to the ferret. They used to call that little bar the ferret. I don't know why. And fill that up, and he'd drink all day, but they only picked up a little bit like that. There was a big crowd of them who drank, 30, 40 pinters a day. And I aimed to be like these people. They were my heroes. You know, not rock stars. I went to a lot of rock concerts, and I went to one at Windsor. The Who were playing. We had a commune, being a beatnik, we had a commune and a beer tent. And the stage and that was all across here. And I never saw any of the singers. They told me about how the Who had wrecked their guitars and that. I didn't see it. Because all I'd done was commune to the bar. If I didn't fall over and stay at the outside the bar tent. I'd end up over there in the commune. And my father really summed up my my drinking, because he said to me one day, "Do you know, Mick, you're the only person I know who goes out to make a phone call and comes back drunk." And that's how it is. That was the compulsion to start with. The addiction was when I drank daily. You know, the first thing I used to do as soon as I got to work, we had a cellar where they topped up the barrels. And I used to go down there, and in the beams, there was always a pint glass. So as soon as you went to work, we went there. And you could go from 4:30 down there in the morning and get a drink. See, all these people that were drinking, there, I made friends with. And so then I would do that. I would drink there, and then the other guys would come in and we would drink. And it sounds like we'd done no work, really, did it? But we did do work. At the off licence that I used to go through over to get the, because we used to have stages where we went on these different drinks, and sherry was 10 shillings a bottle, draft sherry. So I was sent over, and I'd go over there, fill a couple of bottles up of sherry, and we'd take back and share. And while I used to go over there, I used to look around the shelves out the back. You were allowed out the back for a beer and that. And the shelves, I used to look to see which shelf had been used most. And then I'd steal a bottle of whiskey, rum, gin, whatever was the lowest shelf, I would take bottles from. And then I'd take them back and share them at that stage. Then the stage got to where I'd take it back, we'd share the sherry, but I'd keep the bottle of spirits I'd stolen and I'd drink it. I remember once we had a bottle of vodka, and they'd gone out on a breakdown, and I kind of hit the vodka a little bit too much, so I topped it up with water for them to make it look like it was still there. And as soon as they tasted it, they said, "You've got water in here, Mick." I said, "No, not me. I didn't touch it." You know. What did booze give me? It gave me a wife. Because it took away my virginity, because I know that if I had never took a drink, I would have never chatted a girl up because I didn't have the courage. But I met my wife when I was drunk, and it was a place called Eel Pie Island. And what's wrong with Eel Pie Island?
I don't remember it.
there, we used to wear, like our group, I used to wear a long coat. I had long black hair and a black beard. And I wore a red cord suit and this long coat. And you used to have to queue for drinks. It was very refined, because they didn't give you glasses. You had it all in bottles. And so we used to fill our bottles, pockets out with bottles. And my wife found it very exciting. My girlfriend, the girl I met, she found it very exciting there with the crowd I knocked about with. And she found me very exciting. And, you know, but I know now that once I started going out with her, that my drinking did switch. I drank more because she lived in London, I lived in Henley. And I drank more in the week and just kept myself topped up at weekends. Then when we got married, she saw the extent of my drinking, because I was coming home from work drunk at 5:00. And she blamed the people I worked with, and I allowed her. She blamed the company I worked for, I allowed her. She blamed that we first started off with my mum and dad, and I let her. And because it took all the guilt away from me. And then you know, we got managed to get a flat, and it was the alcoholics' paradise. It was next to a pub, opposite the brewery, and our back garden went into the yard I worked. We had top floor, and the toilet was one floor down. So what I used to do, we had booze indoors, but I used to, in the evening, I would say, I'm just going down to the toilet, and I would run down the three flights of stairs, into the backyard of the pub, in the pub, have a couple of doubles, run back out, and walk up the top flight of stairs, and just sit there watching the telly or whatever we were doing, you know. And I had no problem with alcohol. And all our arguments were always about booze. She used to save money to for the kids, because we had a little son. When we had him, my drinking was controlled for a short time. And then it all come back. She used to save money in a little tin for clothes or things like that, housekeeping. And I would go, if I didn't have any money, I would go through and steal the money out of there. You know, and yet I worked where booze was free. But I still went out drinking. We got a chance to buy a house, which we did. The firm paid they bought the house, and I paid the firm the mortgage out of my wages, which was lucky in the end. And so money was short. And I got involved in selling booze. I had a friend who worked in the wine and spirit stores, and I used to pay £9 for a case of whiskey, or a case of brandy, or a case of gin. And I would sell it at 18. And Sylvie said to me, "Where are you getting all this money from?" And I said, "Private work, dinner times." And she said, "You're a liar." And I said, "No, I'm not." She said, "Well, you come home to dinner." So I stopped going home at dinner times. This little house we had, this terrace house, had a back alleyway all the way down the road to the pub, another pub. And I used to go out the garden, run all the way down the alley, have a couple of drinks and run all back. You know, no, I haven't got a drink problem. We had booze indoors, but I never drank indoors in front of her. I had bottles hidden all over the house, because we used to play these games in my house. Hide and seek. I'd hide a bottle and she would seek it. Follow the leader. I would go out to get a drink and she would follow me. And I used to kept ferrets, and the ferret's shed fell down. So I bought second-hand shed, and had a big glass window in there. And I used to keep booze in there. Sylvie hated ferrets. And so I knew it was safe in there. She wouldn't touch it. And, you know, I kept going in there, and she kept catching me through this big window. And now I'm an intelligent alcoholic. And I thought, right, where else can I? I know, we haven't got a big garden. I'll get an allotment. That'll do it. That'll be all right. So I got an allotment. And to this day, I do not know which is my allotment. I know where the allotments are, and I've never had the courage to ask anyone. And so I used to go over this allotment, and I'd drink over there and plant the bottles. Not one grew. And anyway, One day I was over there and I drank too much. I'd come home, my father-in-law and mother-in-law were there, and there was a very bad argument. I don't know whether it got to fights or not, I can't remember. But that day I told my wife I was an alcoholic. And I would seek help. And I knew at least 2 years before that I was an alcoholic. Because if anything came on about alcoholism on the television, I turned it off. If it was in the newspaper, I hid it so that she couldn't see. Yeah. And I went up to doctors and she followed me to make sure I went there. And I told my doctor that I thought I drank too much. And he said, how much do you drink? I said, no more than anyone else at the brewery. I said, but my wife keeps on about it. And so he gave me a vitamin B injection, a prescription for Valium, and a phone number. Well, I found the Valium very handy. You know, if the booze wasn't quite working, a handful of Valium did. And I made appointments the same time every week. And I would go up to him, I would tell him some lies, he would give me my prescription, my vitamin B injection, I would walk from there across the road into the pub, have a couple of double vodkas, down to our half license, buy a bottle of sherry, steal a bottle, go to the stable, the garage, and that. By lunchtime, she'd be on the phone, he's drunk. And the doctor used to say, he can't be, he's only just left here. That's how much he knew about alcoholics and alcoholism. There must have been another argument or something, and I ended up contacting AA. Well, I think it was me, I have no idea. I have no idea. And two men came out. I know one was a bloke called Tom Rennie, and another bloke, and I don't remember his name now. But they talked to me. Eve of Henley, I was given her phone number, and I phoned her, and she said that she would come to a meeting with me, and I picked her up, and I took her to my first meeting. I came into the room over there and I sat down and I listened to you people. And I thought, I drink more than you for my breakfast, but I haven't got your problems. And I came, there used to be two, a Wednesday and a Friday meeting. And I used to go Wednesday and Friday because Eve used to make sure she'd phone up. Well, we didn't have a phone, but I used to have to use the firm's phone to talk to her every day. And she used to come with me. Silver used to make sure I was clean and tidy. And I'd come to the meeting. I wouldn't listen. I looked for all the differences and I stayed drunk. I always thought I was sober because I didn't drink quite as much on the days I came to AA. I tried doing it the wide end, like a wedge, the wide bit first, going to taper it off like that, and all it done was got wider. I tried all different ways to stop drinking, but I was powerless once I got a drink inside me. I used booze under the bed so that I could just reach under the bed. If it was the summer, I hid in her long boots what was under the thing, you know, because I know she wouldn't use them. And all it done, it got worse and it got worse and it got worse. You know, but what I was doing, I was coming, Eve was told to dump me, because it was too dangerous for her to travel with me in a car. But she didn't. She kept in touch with me. She used to come down to see Sylvia and tell her how nice house she kept. how she looked after the kids. And I would come in and say to Sylvie, I'd look around the house, there's a cobweb up there. You don't clean this house. You know, your mum and dad, I'd pick on them because that was the easiest way to cause an argument, and off I'd go. But what happened was I kept, when Eve dumped me, and not dumped me, it sounds bad, doesn't it? Eve, I came to the meetings by myself. I came in blackouts. I come in covered in blood sometimes. I came in me overalls covered in diesel. And then anyway, Sylve decided enough was enough because we had a little girl and she forgot to feed her and she feared for her own sanity. Now, Sylvia joined Al-Anon just after I joined AA because they used to have in Upper Hayford, used to have an American air base and they used to, this group used to get the films and they would come down and in a shed back here, we used to come out and see the films. And Sylvie came with me to see the film. And while talk was on, she kept saying to me, are you listening? You are not asleep, are you? You know. And somebody from Al-Anon noticed her and they said to her, I think you need Al-Anon. And when they told me, she said, I'm joining Al-Anon, I thought, great. They allow you to drink. That's perfect. And one of the things that they told Sylvie, if he comes in really drunk and that, don't fight him or get up, make him a cup of tea. She said, make him a cup of tea or I'll throw the effing tea all over him. And things like that. Anyway, she'd gone. I still came to the meetings. And anyway, I reached a stage where I woke up one morning and I knew if I left the house that morning, I would be dead. I tried suicide two or three times. Didn't work. I remember slashing my wrists and saying to her, look what you made me do. She took me to the hospital once and the next time I'd done it, she said, you cut them, you get there by yourself. And that's how Al-Anon worked for her. And anyway, I woke up one morning, I knew I would, if I went to work, I would be dead. And I phoned my boss up and told him the story of what's happening. He turned up, his wife turned up, a doctor turned up, Sylvie turned up, and they sectioned me to a place called BA, a Victorian mental asylum. We had the drying out room in there, didn't we, up there? And I was in there for a while, and I reached yet another rock bottom for a bloke going berserk for drink and drugs in there. He was a very violent Irishman, and I helped to hold him down but while they injected him. But I hit such a rock bottom that they said I could go home, but not Henley. I had to go and live in London until there was a bed available in their drying out unit. And I went there, and there was the bloke who ran it was called Dr. Harry Harvey. You did, yeah. And he was assessing me, and I said to him, "Don't ask me about me. Ask me wife," and walked out. And then next time I went to see him, well, next time when I had to call back in, they said, "You can come here for a month." I did. I didn't get involved in anything. I left there on fear for 2 months, and I planned a drink. Breakspears was old in a pub next door. I was open. People were inviting me. It was Christmas Eve, 75. And people were inviting me in there for a drink. And they knew who and what I was, but they were talking minerals. And I knew if I went in there that mineral would be laced and I would lace it. So I went home full of resentment. I didn't go there. I went home and the resentment grew, and I planned to get into this meeting, come down to this meeting. And I said to Sylvia, I said to her, is there a meeting tonight? She said, I'll phone a friend of mine in Al-Anon and find out for you. And she said, came back and said, yes, there is a meeting, Mick. So I said, I'm going to it, Sylv. I'll go and get, because I crashed my car and I didn't have a car. And I said, I'll catch the bus. And my plan was, have a drink before catching the bus, get into Reading, have a drink, go to the meeting, because they all know me, because of Sylvie and Al-Anon and that. So have a drink, go to the meeting, have a drink after the meeting, get the bus back to Henley, have a drink, and go home and tell her what wonderful meeting it was. The phone rang, and it was a man named Bob. And he said, I wasn't going tonight, Mick, but I'll come and get you. And I thought, you bastard. And I got there. Anyway, we got there. On the way there, he said, Mick, you helped me so much when you used to come to the meeting and you were drinking days. He said, you really helped me. My ego swelled up. And I said, how, Bob? He said, I looked at you and I thought, I don't want to be like you. And he said, so I didn't take a drink. And I got to the meeting, all the same people there, and I looked around, and they asked me where I'd been, and I told them, and they said, if we'd known, we would have visited. And I thought, well, they're not quite as bad as my mind said they were. And end of the meeting, I thought to myself, I want to be like you. And I became willing to go to any length. And when I got home, Sylvie said, how was it, Mick? I said, it was a good meeting. I enjoyed it. And I feel different. But I said, I'm not promising that I'll stay sober, because I can't do that. Because people spoke of a year of sobriety. And I thought, impossible. How can anybody go a whole year? And I don't even remember how old the oldest person sober was. I think it's only about 8 years, you know, but that was a lifetime, you know, a lifetime. And so Eve and I were about again. My father-in-law sold me a little old car cheap, and because Sylvie said that I needed a car for to get about to go to meetings. And Eve was the contact number for AA in Henley. And she, there was only me and her from Henley. So she'd get in touch with me, phone me up, because we had a phone by then. She'd phone me up and say, Mick, we've got another one. And off we'd go. And so that was my first bit of service in AA. And off we used to go. And I used to say to her, Eve, I don't know what I've got to do. I won't know what I've got to say. You know, I'm too new. And she said, drive on, Mick. She said, if I dry up, you come in. Well, Eve could talk for England. She was fantastic, a fantastic person, you know. And we went everywhere, all over the place. She told me about a meeting in Bampton. And it was, his name was Bill. And she said, in this meeting, it's held in this house. And I expect Jim remembers and Terry remembers. He had a butler. And you were served with tea and cakes in there. The butler would come around during the meeting giving you tea and cakes. And I thought, this is nice. This is the type of meeting I'd like. And we got there and knocked on the door. And his daughter came. I forgot her name now.
Maxine,
that's it. Maxine came to the door. And Eve said to her, we've come to the meeting, Maxine. And she said, I'm sorry. It's not here anymore. And Bill's been dead for a year. I thought, yeah, just my luck, innit? all the, you know, poshest meeting in the world, and I can't go to it. So we went off to, I think it was Woodstock or somewhere like that, to a meeting, and, you know, from there. But we got around all over the place. And Eve was a very kind, loving person, you know, and she taught me all the soft way, softness. Well, she brought all the softness out of me. And, you know, and I found that she was justifying some of my wrongdoings. And so I thought, I need a stronger person. And I'd been introduced to a bloke called Jack of Slough. And we used to do Maidenhead meetings and Slough meetings. Anyway, I asked him if he'd be my sponsor, and he said yes. And I thought, great, this is all right now. But I think, well, I didn't choose the wrong one. I thought I did at first, because he wouldn't allow you, yes, but. As soon as you said yes, but, he'd say to you, you're trying to get away, get out of it. I'm not talking to you. And he one day he said to me, can you give me a lift home? And I said, yeah, I'll do that, Jack. And I took him home, and he said, I want you to stop here. And we stopped, and he said, see that Eiffel license? And I said, yeah. And he said, right, he said, if you want this fellowship, you don't have to worry about that. But he said, if you want to mess about in this fellowship, he said, get out of the car and go straight in there, because I don't want to know. And I knew what he meant, and, you know, and he took me through the steps. He introduced me to lots of people. There was a Polish George. I got to know him. He said to him, me, he said, now Polish George, he used to kill his chicken with an axe in the front garden, and the police used to come after him. And I thought, well, there's one to keep away from, isn't there? You know, and when I first came in, people, the older members, used to watch you. And they'd put their arm around you and they'd say, how's your gratitude? And you would say, it's fine, thank you, fine. Well, here is what you will do. And that's how the service went. You will, not will you, you will. I was a tea person, and they sacked me because the tea wasn't good enough. Yeah, I used to count the tea bags from the previous people who used to do it, but they sacked me. And no one's ever, ever asked me to be a tea person since. Then, from getting the sack, after a little while, they made me a literature person. I'm not a reader. I can tell you that. I have to learn from you people. And because I read between lines. And I thought, strings attached, I better read all these books. I couldn't afford to buy them. So I used to read, take them home and read them. And I thought, they're going to ask me questions about this, the fellowship. And I've got to have the answers. And no one's ever asked me a question about it. When my time was up, they moved me up from literature to treasurer. And I used to count the money in the meeting, take it home, count it again, write it in my little book. End of the month, I would add it all up. And if there was too much money in there, I used to take it out. And if it wasn't enough, I used to put it back, because I used to think, you're not allowed to make mistakes in AA. How do we learn? We learn from our mistakes. Then they made me a secretary. And from that instant, you all belong to me. It made me go to meetings. And I'd listen to the chair. And if you were good enough, you came to my meeting. But if you weren't, no chance. And then after that, I was a GSR, And I got introduced to the gods, because you had to go to intergroup. And I thought, these big gods and that up there, that was all they were people like Terry and such like. You know, just ordinary members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I had these grand ideas about all these higher people. And I got involved in different services in AA that I thought were beyond me. And I used to say to the people, will you help me? If they used to say, you know, you will do this, will you help me? Yes, we'll be right behind you, Mick. When there's a problem, look around for them. You won't find them. They're gone. So you have to solve it yourself. But who benefited from all this? Me. I said, you didn't know me. I'm different. You knew me. You read me like a book. And you put me in different services. One was trust. Gave me trust. You might have. You put me in as a secretary to make me listen to what was going on. And then GSR for responsibility from group back to intergroup, you know. And everything I've done in AA, I've benefited from. Now, Sylvie was in Al-Anon and I was in AA. And in the Watlington House, they used to say, to the AA, you should go to open Al-Anon meetings. And the Al-Anons were told, you should come to AA open meetings to see that your alcoholic isn't unique or different. And we did. And I learned a lot of my emotions through Al-Anon. They didn't talk much about emotions. I learned a lot of through that. And we used to get together a lot. And we used to have AA and Al-Anon speakers at the tables, which was fantastic, I thought. And but in our house, we were kind of, we'd go up together, and sometimes one would be a bit further than the other, and sometimes we partied. But we were working the programs together. And sometimes we would say to each other, you're off your program. And then the other one would say, well, you must be for picking me up. And I was a very good member in the room. But sometimes I wasn't such a nice person indoors. And when I was slamming doors or doing things like that, something came in my head and said to me, would you do that if there was an AA member standing behind you? Of course I wouldn't. So I used to tell myself that, as I was doing wrong, would you do that, Mick, if there was someone standing behind you? And I used to think, no, of course I wouldn't. I learned to love in this fellowship, and it was given to me by a lady named Tokyo Jean, and I said this morning, I was at a meeting and I said, I love everyone in the meeting, but I don't like me. And she said, you love no one, Mick, because before you can love anyone else, you have to learn to love yourself. And I used to have to say to myself every day, I'd do something and I'd say, I've done that, not for a slap on the back or a reward, is because I wanted to. And I learned to like me. Today, I am the best I can be. I might have been a better person yesterday, or maybe tomorrow, but today, I'm the best I can be. I found my higher power in this fellowship, you know, a power greater than myself, and I believe in it. But mine, I'm not a religious person. I believe in nature. That is far more powerful than anything I can imagine, and I believe in nature, and so I use that. I do use word God, I pray every morning and I pray every night. I thank God every morning for getting me through the night and that I wake up. And at night I thank him every night for the day I've had, whether it's good or bad. We had our life planned out, Sylvia and I. We were going to do all these different things. When the children grew up, when they were growing up, we bought a caravan so that we could travel about. And we were very lucky because we had good in-laws, and sometimes they'd have the kids for 2 weeks while we went caravanning. And we always went to meetings together, anywhere we went. We said when we were retired, we bought a timeshare in Tenerife so that when we retired that we could go over there. We had bought a caravan and sighted it. And we had all of these plans and that, which is fine. We can plan for the future, but we mustn't plan the results. Because, I'll come back a bit further. We were told we would not have grandchildren. And my son is a manic depressive, and he said, I'm not having children because I do not want to pass this disease on. He also has problems with drug and alcohol, but he's been clean and sober for quite a while. He has a drink. He's not an AA member or anything. He didn't want to know. He didn't even want to know Alateen. My daughter went to Alateen, but not because of my drinking, because she never saw me drink, because she was being bullied at school, and her mother was an Alateen sponsor, and she knew about the program. She knew about all the alcoholics that came home, and so she went to Alateen to learn for herself, to look after herself, and it worked wonderfully for her. They said they weren't going to have children. She was a careers woman, and her partner was. Anyway, one day they came in and they said to their mother, I do not want you to cry or make a fuss, but we're trying for a family. And she burst out crying. I did as well, but didn't let nobody see. And my daughter made a fuss. Anyway, we had a grandson. And I was looking after him one day, greatest honour. And I was walking up and down because he was crying on my shoulder. And I looked in a mirror and I got the reflection back. I didn't think, great, look at this is me. And I thought, this would not be happening if it hadn't been through AA. You know, and then he was an angel, absolute angel. And then we had the devil, a little girl. And and one day we were sitting down, I was sitting down, she was climbing all over me. And she put her arms around, she was on my shoulders, put her arms around my neck, and she turned around like that, right in front of me like that. And I thought, the bitch is going to bite me. And she'd give me a kiss. And I melted. My daughter got involved in helping women, because she had trouble breastfeeding, helping women breastfeed. And she said to me one day, we need a couple of carers, children, with the children, while I'm teaching in this room. And she said, I'll put your name forward. I love children, so it was all right. And, when you think, I am a drunk, and I was given all these trusts for being sober. And just over 3 years ago, my wife was ill. She had a bad back. And the diagnosis turned out that it was cancer of the spine. She was in the hospital just up the road here and diagnosed. And she said to me, You know, she went in for pleurisy. They thought it might be pleurisy, and because her breathing was bad, and to have her back scanned. And when they scanned her, they found that she had cancer of the spine, and it was incurable. And I went in there, and she said, "Told me." And I said, "Well, when they can operate, are you coming home?" Because I thought she went in for the day. And she said, "No, they won't let me out." And so they done the operation. I shared a little bit this morning about the letter she wrote before the operation, because they said that she might not survive the operation. So she wrote a letter to all of us not to be opened till after her death. And they'd done the operation. They removed the kidney, part of her spine and all that. And she came home, and she was pretty good for a year. She involved herself in Al-Anon and still and everything. She'd done what she could. I used to take her, as she did deteriorate, I took her to Al-Anon meetings in a wheelchair and such like, and we got about. And gradually she started deteriorating. And, you know, and 6 months ago, just over 6 months ago, she died. And, you know, and, but before she died, she'd done an end-of-life plan. And it went exactly as she put it down, you know, because everything went right. She always used to say to me, "Mick, it's all right for you. You'll have a lot of people at your funeral. I know nobody." And when she, when the funeral was, there was 150 to 200 people there. You know, somebody that thought she wasn't loved, she was dearly loved in this fellowship in Al-Anon, and that. And you know, she was an inspiration to me. You know. And why I'm telling you this is also last year in February I had a brother die. In June I had a brother die, and in August I had my wife die. And I've not needed to take a drink over it, because this fellowship, if you follow follow the suggestions of this program, and believe in something greater than yourself, you do not need to drink. Jack Brennan said, he said to God, "God, why did you remove my wife after 26 years of sobriety? Why did you take her away from me?" And God said to him, "I did not take her away from you, Jack. I gave you her for 26 years. And that's how I look at it. I had the privilege to be given my wife for, I can't remember, 43 years, 44 years. And, you know, and she taught me so much. AA has taught me, you know, how to live my life. We talked about it before she died. She even said to me, "I'll get you a new wife, a girlfriend before I die." And I said to her, "I don't want a girlfriend. Like, you know, what I'll do, Sylv, is I'll get a dog and I'll get some more ferrets." She said, "That's it, isn't it? Being replaced by a dog and ferret." But, you know, we had a wonderful life. I've learnt a lot. I need not take a drink a day at a time because of what I've learnt in this fellowship. And I say that I do not learn from books. It's you people in AA that has taught me how to live this life. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bless you, Mick. always dynamite, hardcore stuff. I just have one small worry question. You mentioned that when you were a secretary, you went all around the region checking chairs, and if you were any good, only if you were very good, you'd be asked. You never asked me.
Well, you were mafia. That's why. We heard about Beaconsfield, the mafia.
Oh, no. This is being taped.
If you didn't get sober, they'd break your legs, we were told.
Well, this is great for people who may be new. Yeah. Great, wonderful.
Yeah.
Hearing from Jim about the Wild West and now the mafia and breaking
I'll tell
your
you
legs.
About Big Pat.
No.
Now, Big Pat, his driving was absolutely scary.
Yeah.
I used to go to meetings with him, committee meetings, and he'd be driving down the motorway at 90 to 100.
Yeah.
And he was an eye-to-eye contact person. And he would talk to you like this.
And in the back seat.
And my hand used to be an inch away from the steering wheel because he'd wander towards the crash barrier and such like. And I said to Beaconsfield, because we bickered a lot over at Beaconsfield, and he was sharing, and I said to him, do you know Beaconsfield has the greatest amount of recovery. People that go to Beaconsfield for the first time never take a drink after. And I said, I've just worked it out why. I said, you have a phone call, a 12 step to do, so you send Big Pat out. He drives them to a meeting and back, and they think, if we take a drink, he'll come and get us again, so I'm not taking a drink. Thank you, Terry.
A good note to finish on. Right. Just before we go to the promises, there's an invitation for anybody here who wants to go to the Saturday Fifth Tradition meeting being held in the hall tonight at 8 o'clock. Now we come to the promises. Chapter 6, page 83 to 84 of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we've gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled amongst us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
If you would like to join me in the Serenity Prayer using the word God, as we define it. God grant us serenity.